The Disruptors are back. In this episode, I get to talk to the Disruptors, a group of six of us, including me, Nicole Lavoie, that have expertise in different areas related to women's sport. The Disruptors include Katie LaBelle, Jada Mumchu, Dunya Antunovic, Ann Peguero, and Nancy Lowe, who you will hear from shortly. This group started meeting virtually during COVID, and we agreed today was a complete lifesaver for all of us, and we desperately missed talking to each other weekly as we came out of COVID and our lives got busy. We talked about coming up with a new model for women's sport during those COVID months, and in 2022, we released a thought piece titled Disruptors, Driving a New Model of Women's Sport. You could download that report on the Tucker Center website at tuckercenter.org. But in the Disruptors report, we discussed turning points and posited disruptions to the normative model of sport that was created by and for men, run by men, and that upholds the privilege, hierarchy, and status quo of men's sport in relation to women's sport. And all of us from our different perspectives have been studying this from sport management, sport sociology, sport communication, sport finance, sport marketing, sport media. And due to a multitude of factors, including the global COVID-19 pandemic, calls for social justice, populist attacks and backlash against women's rights, and the effect Title IX has had on the athletic careers of not only the Disruptors, but on the athletic careers and empowerment of girls and women in the U.S., which has resulted in unprecedented disruption in women's sport, and specifically among women athletes. So in this paper, we wanted to capture and point out key digital disruptions that were situated within the broader historical and sociocultural context of women's sport in the U.S. That's one thing that I find interesting lately is like, oh, the growth of women's sport, it's so popular in viewership and investment, but the groundwork was being laid for decades. And now we're really seeing what that foundation is doing in terms of transforming women's sport as we know it today at the end of 2024. So some of the disruptions that we argued about in the paper were there are generational disruptions. The traditional model of sport was designed by men for men. But what was talked about less is that the fact that the model was also traditionally prioritized in the baby boomer generation. And how could that model change with changing generations? We also argued that in just a decade, sport marketers moved from a reliance on traditional one-way media filtered by communication professionals to a dynamic two-way dialogue that focused on authenticity and audience engagement. Another disruption we outlined was that fans of women's sport increasingly have a place to display their fandom, where there was little or no prior opportunity. And we argued that the traditional model of sport fandom is being disrupted. One more is that women athletes begin using the power of social media to build their own brands and craft narratives that countered and bypassed traditional media storylines. We saw that women athletes were gaining agency and becoming brands with considerable influence and marketing power. And lastly, we argue that companies were starting to reset and rebalance their sponsorship and sponsorship decisions to align with stated values and connect with an underserved market. Really, in the Disruptors report, which is really fun for us to look back on 2 years later, which you'll hear shortly, is that we argued that those who were clinging to the traditional sport business model would be well advised to see how women's sport, fans of women's sport, and women athletes were using technology to disrupt the system that never valued them, and in the process have created the path forward, a new path that we are now seeing come to fruition in 2024. So since March of 2022, so much has happened in women's sport. So we thought we'd get the Disruptors back together to talk about what we've noticed share what we're working on currently, and make some bold predictions on future disruptions. I know you will enjoy this episode of Amazing Women. I know I did, because they are doing amazing work and continuing to disrupt the system in their own ways. Take a listen. All right, let's talk. On this version of Tucker Center Talks, we have a very special group that has come back together. The band is back together. These are a group of my colleagues that we call ourselves the Disrupt Hers. Very clever name. Thank you very much. And we have not been together on the screen in over 2 years. So this is way overdue. So I'm going to have them introduce themselves so you know who is who, and you can attach a name to each disruptor as we talk the rest of our podcast. So again, I'm Dr. Nicole Lavoie. I'm the director of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota.
It's great to see everyone. I'm Dunja Antunovic. I'm an associate professor of sports sociology at the University of Minnesota. I'm also affiliated with the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication, and I work with the Tucker Center contributing to research on media coverage.
I'm Katie LaBelle, and I'm coming at you from Toronto in Canada today. I'm at the University of Guelph.
I'm Dr. Nancy Lowe from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I'm the director of the Intercollegiate Professional Sport Management Program and also a director of the Sport Innovation Institute at UNLV.
And I am Dr. Jay Damumju. I'm a professor of sport management at the University of New Haven.
Okay, and I'm Anne Pigoreau, and I'm the Lang Chair in Sport Management and the Director of the International Institute for Sport Business and Leadership at the University of Guelph, north of the border, like Katie.
All right. Well, now you know who the disruptors are, and you can put a voice to each name and a name to each voice. And we published in March of 2022 a paper called Disruptors: Driving Change for Women in Sport. It's free. You can download it on the Tucker Center website. And since that, in the March of 2022, there has been a lot of disruptions in women's sport. So many that we could literally probably talk for the next 10 hours on all the disruptions. But when we wrote that kind of thought leadership paper, it was really before things really took off in women's sport. It was starting to ramp up post-COVID, but it really has grown and in so many ways. So I wanted to bring the disruptors together at the end of 2022 to talk about, from each of our perspectives, what has been the biggest disruption in women's sport from your perspective? Because we're all coming from different disciplinary perspectives. So who wants to start us off?
I can jump in. I mean, as one of the Canadians on the team, we've got professional women's sport in Canada now, which is a huge deal. So the PWHL launched successfully last year. We've got a WNBA franchise coming into Toronto next year. We're thrilled. It's improving accessibility, I think, is the biggest disruption. It's funny, I've got a young daughter and she's been to a few PWHL games. We've gone out and she knows there's a basketball team coming. We went to the Canada game together. She can turn on TV and watch a women's sporting event just about any day of the week. She was Summer McIntosh for Halloween. She asked me over the weekend, she didn't realize that men were playing hockey. To think about that as a disruption, that her worldview, she's a sporty little girl and she doesn't know that there's options. She doesn't know that men play sports in some realm. Like, what a time to be a 7-year-old. I think that accessibility is going to be a huge generational change, and I can't imagine a stronger disruption to sports, and how that will grow and what that will look like in the future because of those experiences and that ability to be able to consume women's sport in a way that we never had the chance to do.
I love that. I always love your perspective, Katie, because you come at it from the lens of looking at it through your daughter's eyes and her perspective. And that is so cool. I think you had emailed us is that, oh, my daughter thinks didn't know that men played hockey. I'm like, I mean, how disruptive is that? I love that.
She started playing hockey too, as a result of it. So I can't imagine myself as a hockey mom, but she was so inspired by the women she was now able to see and follow and look up to, that she's now playing it too and added that sport to her repertoire. So it's just really cool to be able to watch and see how all of these things that we've researched for all of these years, and we knew the recipe for success, and now it's starting to come to life for this new generation.
That is definitely disruption. So who's up next?
I think for me, that maybe validates what we wrote in 22, if that was the year, it's a blur, is the investors who've come to women's sports. I think Michelle Kang has changed the world with her investments in women's soccer, women's rugby. I think that in Canada, Larry Tannenbaum's investment in bringing a women's WNBA franchise to Toronto, when his major corporation, MLSE, did not want to do it, he stepped outside and said, "I'll do it," and he put the money in. I think Alexis O'Hanrahan and his money into track and field and into his alma mater. And recently, all of these people have finally seen, I think, what we talked about for years, is there's a return on investment for women's sport, and the growth was there. And to see these millions coming in and to find investors, not just one, like Michelle Kang's put money in several different places, like seeing that this return is coming. So I think that rolls into something that we predicted would come, and people probably laughed a little bit at us because they didn't see that we could have an ROI for women's sport, and now it's there and big money's flowing. So to me, that's the biggest thing, maybe that we predicted that came true, but also disrupting women's sport and really vaulting it forward.
So we can also add the unrivaled basketball league generating 20 million in Serie A funding last week, right? So just an additional example to what Anne shared with us. And seeing the investment and how it translates into valuations of these franchises are also incredible, right? So we have seen NWSL valuations from moving to 50 million to 113 to Angel City FC going for 250 million. So, it is impacting the industry in a larger scale, a very exciting time for sure.
Yeah, that was going to be my disruption as well, is just the call out to Angel City FC. And full disclosure, I did get to spend some time with their franchise this summer at the Paris Olympics. So I do have a little bit of a soft spot for what they're doing with their franchise and how they're building it. And that really the social community impact that they take very seriously is how can we as a sport property impact the local community? And I think there's so much nice synergy there with the LA 28 Summer Olympics coming there that they're really on the forefront of how a sport property for women can create social change in the community. And I think the fact that, as Anne and Jada mentioned, that investment when Bob and Willow Iger bought ACFC for $250 million after, it's just a couple of years old, I think that woke people up and said, oh, wow, there's money to be made here. And it just reminded me of a conversation I had with this gentleman who was thinking of investing in an NWSL team in Minneapolis because we don't have one, but we have an MLS team. And he wanted my advice. Oh, I don't know. It's a lot of money, And this was before this happened with ACFC. He's like, I don't know, it was $3, $4 million at the time. He said, do you think that's a good investment? I said, yes, I do. I mean, I'm not a financial advisor, but I'd take that bet. And he didn't do it. And now I just want to call him back and say, I told you so. Now it's going to cost him a lot more than $3 or $4 million. Dr. Lowe, what do you got?
I just want to jump in on that because just yesterday it was announced that Denver is getting an expansion franchise for the NWSL. And now the price tag is up to between 100 and 150 million just for an expansion team. So was it in a good investment for that gentleman from Minnesota? Well, it's a good investment he missed out on, which is again a theme that, has been said for the last 2 years, has been said over and over, get in now if you want to see your investment grow. And so I just wanted to add that to the perspective because it's very real. It's very, very real how much these valuations are increasing.
Good add-on.
I'll shift the conversation a little bit to media coverage, which of course is a part of that larger ecosystem that you all have been talking about. And one of my observations is that, women's sports are becoming mainstream, right? And there is a routine coverage. Obviously, we are in an Olympic and Paralympic year in 2024. So we know that during Olympic years, there is greater attention on women's sports. But in the past, the differences were so stark between Olympic coverage and routine media coverage of women's sport. And right now, it seems like media organizations are actually dedicating airtime, dedicating story time, dedicating attention to women's sports. It's not just a one-off story or conversation. I do not have data to back that up in terms of quantity of coverage. And I know some of our colleagues at other universities are in the process of data collection. So I will be very curious to see whether we're seeing movement and how large that movement might be from that 5% or 10% that we're typically used to in terms of routine media coverage of women's sports, at least in the US. And so I anticipate that we're going to see quite a bit of movement, but I'll talk about this a little bit later, but I do think it will be contextual and it will depend on the market. And so I appreciate that you all are bringing up the expansions, because I think bringing women's sports teams closer to a particular location has the potential to really create excitement and additional interest. And so those are just my preliminary observations. And obviously, I'm curious to see how it all works out in terms of the actual data that we will see in potentially a few months.
Yeah, and I think after we published the Disruptors, we were thinking about, you know, how do we capture what's really happening in the media landscape and get out away from this 4% of media coverage goes to women athletes. And we're like, I don't really think that is true anymore, because it doesn't account for digital and streaming and all the other ways that are being covered for women's sport. And then the Wasserman Collective came out with a report maybe in 23, early 24, that had a different statistic that was around 15%. And so I think, you know, depending on your methodology, you could get different answers. But I think the more of our colleagues that are digging into this, you know, the quantity of media coverage, that will really show growth and disruption in the landscape.
So I'll follow that line of thinking to some degree. Maybe in a little bit more of a less of an optimistic, although it is optimistic in the sense of money being left on the table. So thinking about media rights, unfortunately, even though the Kaplan report from the NCAA debacle with regard to women's basketball during COVID, the Kaplan report suggesting that the valuation of women's basketball could stand alone and that the NCAA could get its get a media rights deal specifically for women's basketball that would be around $100 million or more. Of course, the NCAA passed on that opportunity and did, they always do, which is they bundled everything together, including women's basketball, to do one media rights deal that included all sports except for men's basketball. So I think now I'm going to maybe point to a few missed opportunities that I believe we teased out in our report that still need to be developed further. So clearly women's basketball at the NCAA level has far greater valuation potential, as does women's volleyball, as does softball, as does gymnastics. So, you know, money being left on the table in college sport, while all the powers that be can talk about is how to monetize football, which is clearly a mess. Everyone that follows college football says it's a mess, including those who are part of it. So
can I just jump in on that? Yeah. If I have to hear about one more stupid bowl game that they can't even sell tickets for, and then people are saying, well, no one's interested in women's sport and you can't even fill a quarter of a stadium and, I don't know, the toilet bowl. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
It is. And so that's, you know, that's why it's so important for us to point this out, right? Last year, 2023, the Women's Volleyball National Championship set a record, and we're looking at that happening again this Sunday with, what do we got? We've got Penn State playing Louisville, I believe. And so, you know, record last night with the two semifinals, more parity. We're seeing teams we've never seen before. And with Penn State, we have our first woman coach that I think will, I'm hoping, win a national championship. So, you know, exciting on that side. The WNBA is coming up on a new collective bargaining agreement. And to hold with the media theme, they clearly are looking at all the money that the NBA was able to get in the media rights deal, and saying, where's our piece of the pie? Which they have every right to do, because guess whose ratings are down? The NBA, right? And WNBA ratings have been up. Viewership has been up. It is the perfect time to say, I think we need a little bit more of this piece of the pie. And on that media side, it also points to other areas where there's tremendous opportunity for revenue with regard to women's sport, which I don't recall which report came out with this number, but $4 billion worth of revenue being left on the table for the lack of merchandise in women's sport, which is also something that I think Katie really brought to light for all of us. And, that's a piece that's just the money that would come from sales. We're not even talking about the marketing aspect of what happens when you wear, as you are, Dr. Lavoie Wellesley on your shirt, or like me, WNBA on my shirt, right? That's a marketing message that's gaining visibility that we don't track. We don't track how far that marketing message goes. But in essence, people are paying to market your brand, right? So more merch. More merch. And lastly, I think my big disruption that I'm really excited about is seeing all the women that are creating their own companies where they're actually creating shoes, they're creating gear, they're creating women's sport specific product that has never existed. It's crazy to think there's never been a hockey mask, a catcher's mask, a helmet created for women. And now we finally have companies that are trying to do that. They're, of course, it's amazing in the shoe game, found out that China is the place where it all gets held up because they're like, no, this is not how you create a shoe, right? China says, no, you have to use this footbed. And instead, I believe it was Allyson Felix's company who said, no, look, we know what a shoe for a woman needs to look like. And we're not going to use that old, outdated model that's always been used because it's for a men's foot. So, it's really interesting. The new barriers are coming up, new challenges are coming up, but it's because we've got some phenomenal areas of change that are happening that are super exciting.
Yeah. All good disruptions. And can we circle back to the merch piece? Because I've been wanting to ask all of you, specifically Katie, about the merch, because we would always lament together when we met the disruptors. And I think even on a few of our podcasts is like, why is the women's merch always sold out? Did you make 5 shirts or did you make them all in like extra small and now there's no sizes left? So Katie, what are your thoughts on this? How has the merch game changed or not changed in 2 years for women's sport?
Yeah, we did a study and we tracked the WNBA and the NBA on Fanatics. Fanatics, you all know, is one of my personal taking that one on, but we're updating that. We're doing a 5-year follow-up to kind of get a state of affairs. So we've got some numbers to back up what's changed and what's not. Anecdotally, I think there is some more availability, but if you go onto the Fanatics site, you still have to dig. You still have to dig. There's not the same assortments that are there for men. I think a lot of the times, if you're really excited about celebrating the WNBA championship, you have to wait 3 weeks until they can get you any of the merch. So a lot of the things that are standard in men's sport are still not there. And I think there's still decision makers at the top that don't believe there's a market for it. And so there's some work to be done to be able to convince the powers that be that there's still a market for this. I think, again, if we go back to the youth market, which is it's a passion project for me, but I also think back to the idea of money left on the table. Time and time again, I go to these games and there's nothing available for kids.
Really?
And if you're growing some of these new sport properties, those are your fans. Those are the people that you're going to convert that will have that lifetime fandom. And I'm completely shocked that that's still something that's continued to be overlooked as we go forward and there's increasing amount of attention around this. But we'll have to do it again in the spring when we've got the results back from that follow-up study, and I'll have some numbers to be able to show you how much has changed.
We'll hold you to that. I would say there's probably like you can buy a onesie, like a baby onesie, maybe, but the youth market again, absent. Nancy.
Yeah, I would say at the Fanatics level, 100%, they're not getting it done and they don't seem to care, Katie, because they're Amazon, right? They care about mass quantities. But at the local team level, so Aces here in Las Vegas, they're taking it under their own, right? So they're actually supporting women designers. And, that's kind of the beautiful part. So we know the WNBA athletes are like doing fashion, right? And, there's a lot around that that's kind of been fun. But because of that, now they're embracing brands and trying to lift up brands that are predominantly women-owned that are creating things women want. And guess what? They want stuff for their kids, right? Just like they want for themselves. So at least in some markets, and again, it's market, right? You're going to see some really cool stuff. Maybe that's because I'm in Vegas, but you know, there's definitely a huge market for that. It's another one of those places where the NFL doesn't get women. They never have. They don't care, or so it appears. Money being left on the table, but let's not tell them because we'd rather spend that money on women's sport.
Even when I was at the women's Final Four last spring, and we went to the fan building, the fan experience, and we went the second or third day, not right away, because we wanted a t-shirt. And I'm not really one to buy t-shirts when I go to these things, but I wanted one. So we went, and there was nothing left. And the fan experience was packed with people. You couldn't even move. And all the people going to the merch booth just stood there all forlorn and sad because there was, one thing left, and it's something that nobody wanted, or it was in a weird size.
Yeah, and I would add to that too. I think we've got a couple of new teams that are branching out in Canada here, and a lot of the stuff still seems designed for men. And so I think that's another, there's some habits that need to be broken. And I think we need to start thinking outside of the box a little bit more. And I love some of the work that the female designers are doing. And I think that's probably the road that we need to embrace for the future. But there's still a lot of work to be done in merch.
Well, let's build on what we've talked about. There a lot of us or all of us are working on a lot of exciting things that are related to our passion and our expertise and around women in sport. What are we working on right now that we're super excited about? We have three out of the six disruptors working on a really cool study around women in sports betting, and I've been dying to hear what you're finding. So Jada, Nancy, and Katie, give us a little sneak peek, maybe what you're finding.
I will say our findings remind me the early stages of academic research we have done in women fans and women sports. So I think there is a real great parallel in the sense of approaching women as the sidekick of men in the space. And what we found, it is not the truth. Right. So we are again facing the bias of women are not sport fans. Women don't understand sport and they are only engaging for the social reasons and to, spend quality time with their brothers, husband, their fathers, uncles, whatever it may be. Right. So that assumption is nowhere is validated in our research. Women are aware of statistics. They build models. They have spreadsheets. They spend ton of hours building their own models before they bet, and they are well aware of what the odds are and then what an over under is, and they know how to bet. So we have found some exciting, findings. We have some exciting findings, and it is again, I think, will maybe hopefully get attention from the industry so that they can actually serve the women who are in the market and want to continue to bet while betting responsibly.
So I'm gonna jump in and just lay it out for you, Nicole and Katie. I did this at SMA, thanks to your customer journey piece. I actually named the three types of journeys, which as women, right? Three different women. Journey number one is Katie, and
A pseudonym, Katie, or actual Katie?
it's just a name that happens to be common right now at this age group. So yeah, she's younger. That's another assumption that a lot of people have, is they assume that she's younger, which in this case that group is. So by younger, I mean like 20s, 30s, and she's really doing it for social reasons. She really kind of wants to hang out with, people that are interested in sport, and she's just learning. And so, that's Katie, not spending a lot of money, doing it maybe like once a month. In the middle, we have Kristen. Kristen is much more committed, much more engaged. Kristen is really smart about betting, right? Does her research, but also has some connections, like likes to do it with somebody significant in her life, like a father or, husband. Probably not husband. Usually it's more of a social thing. But she knows her stuff. She knows her teams, and she thinks that she knows what she's doing because she like knows the team. She knows sport, right? And then our last woman I called Kathy, and Kathy is the one with the spreadsheets, as Jada described. Kathy is in it to win it, and she thinks she can do better than the system. like this is a hardcore serious, I shouldn't say hardcore, but she is a serious bettor. And when she loses, it makes her mad. So she knows she's going to get her money back, right? Like she's all about, like she's that bettor.
Is Kathy actually ahead of the odds? Is Kathy winning?
She thinks she is. Yeah. She thinks she can beat the odds. Yeah. And that's what's so fascinating, right? Is these three different journeys are not at all what I think the industry believes about women, because really they think they're all Katie, and they're not.
Interesting.
Not at all. Katie, you want to give more color to that?
I can add a little bit more. I had a chance to speak in Vancouver at New Horizons Safe Gambling Conference. Alongside with a professional from DraftKings and some other folks from industry folks.
Wait, 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 wait. Did you say a safe gambling conference?
Correct.
Okay. I just want to make sure I heard that right.
Well, so just to give perspective, Nicole, my colleagues at the International Gaming Institute are far more interested in protecting people from, I mean, obviously there's people with addiction, gambling addiction, which is very real, but then there's problem gambling is what it's called. So actually the gaming industry and the research that's done is very, very much focused on, you know, helping people, alerting them early, those sorts of things. So.
Yes. So in that conference, there was a lot of, you know, focus on responsible gambling, how to help problem gambling and addiction. And, you know, majority of the conversation, majority of the sessions were focused on that space. Our panel talked about women bettors, and what the assumption is coming from the industry is really all the women who bet in sport is Katie. Young women who bet just to be with their, you know, boyfriends, and it's a social outlet, and they were given instructions or directions on how to bet, and the age range that they thought these folks would be in their mid-20s. Our quantitative results actually brought average age to into mid-40s. So they were really surprised to find out actually women in general who bet in sport are in older age group than the ordinary assumption the industry makes. We have some information about their habits, different type of apps that they use, different types of sports that they bet on, predominantly NFL, NBA. WNBA is the most bet on women's sport. It's particularly due to availability. But these women who participated in our research is mostly immersed in the experience, and they enjoy being part of it. There's an intellectual component to it. They want to beat the odds, and they want to beat the system, and they are certainly looking for a community as well. So there is the social aspect, but it is not pertinent to, you know, it has to be my boyfriend, my husband, my father. So it is a larger social need that they are seeking.
That's so interesting. I'm glad I asked you about this. Katie, do you want to weigh in, since this is also your study and, you know, we have a Katie in the betting.
I wonder how that got in there.
Trio, you know, that maybe is coincidental, but maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing is it's similar to what we've been studying around women's sport fandom. They've been a segment that hasn't been taken seriously. And I think we talked from the customer journey standpoint, you know, the barriers they face is just trying to wrap their heads around the lingo, and they don't see themselves in the advertising. They don't feel like the industry reflects them or is speaking to them. Everyone that we talked to was very aware that, you know, they were othered and not something that the betting industry was targeting. And they see themselves as a viable market, which I think they are. There's a ton of money being left on the table. So, you know, I think there's some real practical insights that are going to come from this research and how to better market to some of these women, to how to respect the fact that they see this as a viable form of entertainment, which I think, again, a lot of people we talked to, this was something that they're doing for fun, and they're looking for a community. You know, that's another big theme that we're seeing around women's sports, just how big this community is. And again, not to bang the drum too many times, but women's sport are not a monolith. And we talked to so many different types of bettors, and, you know, the journeys were all a different story. And it just really underscored the diversity of the people who are betting on women's sport, or betting on sport in general.
Betting on sport. Yeah. Yeah. Jada, one more comment, then we'll move on to some other topics people are working on.
Very briefly, Katie's comment prompted me to talk about the advertisement piece. And when she said that, you know, these women don't see themselves or that cannot relate themselves to the advertisements, that actually was one of the questions that we received as a panelists at the conference, and the folks actually have no idea how to appeal to women. So that was interesting. They didn't understand that there needs to be a different type of advertisement and how to frame that to resonate with women. So that was an interesting finding or for me to insight capture from that panel session.
That just speaks to the power of the work that we've done collectively and in subgroups of the disruptors that really is ahead of the curve and driving change in the industry. So thank you three for doing that important work. Dunya, let's hear. What have you been working on that you're excited about right now?
So my focus is typically on international sports. Obviously, it's an Olympic and Paralympic year, so I've done some work on that. But the project that I'm really excited about is actually local. So I received a grant from the University of Minnesota to support a project about women's sports coverage on the local level, and particularly two interview journalists who cover women's sports. And so we've conducted 38 interviews so far, and we are continuing next semester. So we're not quite ready yet to provide insight into the nuances of the findings, but it's really striking to see some of the maybe tensions and also alignments with the changes that are happening in women's sports. And so one of the reasons that I was really interested in talking to journalists is because precisely what we're talking about here, right, that there is a momentum around women's sports, there's changes. Yet I sort of assume then, as so far I'm learning that that's the case on the local level, the relevance of that momentum really depends. And so we're seeing that in the Twin Cities, you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul, women's professional sports organizations are receiving a lot of attention. You know, traditional media outlets like newspapers, television stations seem really committed to covering the professional women's sports teams. And even, obviously, we have the Lynx here, PWHL team, the Frost is here. There was a lot of excitement around them. Aurora FC, which is not a part of the NWSL, it's a pre-professional team, is in some ways treated as a professional team in the media market here in terms of visibility of games. At the same time, one of the issues is that the disruptions that are happening on the national level in terms of declining resources, restructuring, are very much affecting the work of sport journalists as well. And so right now, one of the concerns that I have is, you know, if this restructuring is happening, what does that mean in terms of investment in women's sports? So, for example, if a journalist who has covered women's sports for 25 years retires, or, you know, decides to pursue another option,
quits.
Right. What happens to women's sports coverage? Will the media organization hire somebody else? And also, will that person be able to build the same kinds of relationships, or to build the kind of relationships that can lead to continuity in coverage? And so I see maybe a little bit too much reliance still on individual journalists rather than structural investment in this market. To my knowledge, there is only one beat writer dedicated specifically to a women's sports team. The Lynx has a beat writer at the Star Tribune, which is the paper of record here. But other than that, women's sports coverage is sort of whoever is available and you know, kind of runs across maybe the media organizations. So those are some of the preliminary insights. Obviously, a lot more to go in terms of data analysis.
I was going to be surprised if you didn't pick that one, Dunya, since I know how excited you've been about the process and your interviews and all the data that's coming out and the insights. So we'll be very curious to read your publications and reports and findings from that. And I know, Anne, you do a lot of work in media, and I don't want to tee you up to say you have to pick something in the media research you're doing, because I get a Google alert on you like once a week. And you're very busy and very prolific publishing things in lots of different areas. So what are you working on right now that you're excited about?
Well, those publications have a lot to do with great people I work with. So you'll see me in areas you wouldn't have thought, like motherhood and sport recently.
I did see that this week. I was like, Anne is the last author on this. This is fascinating.
It's a really great work led by my colleague, Dr. Carrie McGannon out of Laurentian. So she's kind enough to have me along for the ride. So I'm learning, given not being a mother, and we're studying mother athletes and media. So It's probably not my place to talk about that one. But let me talk a little bit about maybe where I've seen things for me shift since the Disruptors report. So, you know, look, we all tried really hard with that report and our work to try to work with industry, right? We really thought, hey, this is the right time. The women's sport industry will want to work with us.
Us meaning academics who have a lot of expertise.
Academics who have a lot to offer. And we had some pretty bad false starts with them. And for me, that was kind of like, do I want to keep banging my head against a wall that they don't want to work with academics, they want to get another report from Deloitte kind of area. So I shifted a little bit. And I would say sort of got found by a group of women who are, you know, because we're talking about women's sport being really positive right now. And it's women's professional leagues that have been around for a while that are doing well. So some women who are in the ski and snowboard industry found me. And I spent a week with them last year about this time in Revelstoke, BC. I'd never been there before. Sat in a heli ski lodge while they went heli skiing and I did not. And these are top women who are in the free ride world tour, who win, who've been Olympians and are really struggling to make a living in their sport. And it's a highly expensive sport. It's also, to be honest, and they recognize this, a highly white sport. And so they're looking for, you know, information for data to help them push back on contracts that they get put in front of them that pay them nothing. They mostly get gear that they then resell to make money. And so I'm going to keep working with them. They formed a group called Sister Summit. They've now made themselves a nonprofit. And we're going to do some work to help them get gender equality moving in their industry. So I think when we think about how it's moving for the WNBA, and high profile women's sports, there's some that we see, you know, high profile, they're in Warren Miller films, they're in all these things, but they're not making a living other than from some of their sponsors. And so that's kind of a passion project to help them. Had a great session with them. I mean, you know, when you do, and I shared some data with them, I did a survey and then we did some analysis, my students on media coverage by their sponsors of women, and literally people, there was, you know, 25 women in the room and they're like, what the F? This is the truth. We need this data. We're being asked to sign contracts where we're not guaranteed any sort of, you know, coverage from our sponsors. And we showed them that like 6% of the sponsors' posts were women actually doing their sport. They were astounded. And so I think those types of things, like bringing the experience we had in writing the Disruptors and thinking about how can other small groups of women's sports take advantage of that and learn from it. So they're a group that's welcomed me in and I haven't had to bang my head on the wall, which is nice. And I think the other community that I'm working a lot with is parasport now. And I feel, I'll say it here, that I think the Paralympics and parasport are on a parallel journey to women's sport. So if you're out there and listening and you want to invest, this is where actually the ROI is going to keep coming too. So I do a lot with the Canadian Paralympic Committee and I've found a really awesome, open, welcoming community to work with there that want research and want academics. So for those who didn't want to work with us, well, I was able to find some who did.
Well, and I think that's a really good call out, Anne, because, you know, I think many of us on the Disruptors team felt very similar to what you just voiced, and that, you know, why bang our head against the wall? There are people that want to work with us that do value what we know and what we bring to the table. And I think I too have found those spaces now too. And I'm not looking back. I'm only looking forward and saying yes to the things and working with the people and the organizations that really do want to work with us. So yeah, when one door closes, others open. All right. I know, Nancy and Katie, we heard a little bit about what you're working on right now in terms of sports betting, but I want to give you the opportunity to jump in and tell us about something else you might be working on.
Yeah. So I guess we're working on a recap of some of the what's happened around merchandise. So that's out. We're working on sports betting. I'm also still continuing to be fascinated around the idea of awareness in women's sport. And I think this maybe segues too into what I think a next, you know, future disruptions might be, but I had the opportunity to teach a science of sport fandom course in the fall. We just launched it and it was a really fun course to teach. And it was in the fall, so it coincided with the WNBA playoffs. And so, you know, we've been doing this for years. I've been trying to incorporate women's sports into all of the courses that I teach. And usually people groan and it's not super popular. And so I did a straw poll we've got the WNBA franchise coming to Toronto. I did a straw poll to see how many people were tuning in to the WNBA playoffs. It was crickets. Not one single hand in the classroom went up. And so we started a module around the WNBA, and it coincided squarely with the playoffs. And we went through different touch points. And so they had to follow some of the athletes and teams on social media. I shared the story. We connected with Ed Jones, and she shared the story of how the orange hoodie came to be. And they got into a bracket. So they had to place, they had to pick who they was going to win. And we went through, they watched The Power of the Dream in 144, and they start to got a his, they got a history of the league. And by the end of those 3 weeks, we were about a week out from the finals. They were starting to organize viewing parties. I had converted an entire class of over 90 students into WNBA fans. And it was so much fun to teach, but it also taught me a really big lesson. And I think you're talking about, the psychological continuum model, and there was some theory in the course too. But there's a sticky part of that awareness to attraction step I learned with women's sports fans or just sports fans. And I think I really am become fascinated by that. And I've been talking to a couple of different colleagues around how to get some research rolling on this, and maybe it'll be something that's incorporated into a future generation or iteration of the course next year. But it's almost like when it comes to women's sport, people are in this pseudo awareness stage. And they think they know what it's all about, but in reality, they have a lot of misinformation around it. And so I think what I learned from that little science experiment that I ran in class was that it might be different what changes, what you need to change that awareness to attraction, because you kind of have to fix what they know or what they're aware of before they can move through that fandom continuum. And so I'm playing around. I'm really excited by it. It was such a cool experience. I'd just gone through all the grading and the course evaluations, and every student commented on that piece. So I think there's something there, and there's something to it. And I think it could be a real game changer if we can put our finger on it.
I mean, talk about a disruption. You disrupted 90 students in terms of what they thought about women's sport. That is real disruption.
It was so fun. And just to see the light bulbs going off and to see them, like they were trying to buy merch and they were trying to do all the things. And what a cool thing on the heel, or we're just about to welcome a new franchise into our country.
Does it have a name yet?
Oh yeah, don't go there.
Oh.
The Toronto Tempo. Yes.
Okay, well, it could be worse.
It could always be worse. Lukewarm
Could
reception.
always be worse.
It's not bad. It's not
There
bad.
was a weird leak where it just, yeah, there was a, anyway, I think that there is that broader step around that awareness and pushing back against some of those highly ingrained stereotypes. And if we can kind of reteach, and whether that's, getting kids like my daughter and her friends from scratch and teaching them what it's all about and getting them to games and seeing it, or re-educating, this generation of alphas or whatever the case may be, if we can go through the different generations, there's some magic if we can work around that and understand that we have to maybe approach that fandom part a little bit differently.
I love that. Thanks for sharing that. Nancy, do you have something you're working on that you want to share as a disruptor?
Sure. So a little bit of a departure, but also still very relevant, especially with what's been happening in women's sports. So we're looking at athlete career transitions and post-professional career. So it's really interesting, a couple of different angles that we're taking on it from kind of the women versus men piece. We've analyzed collective bargaining agreements and we've looked at retirement benefits and basically looked at those across like the major leagues, but then also the women's sport leagues. And as you might imagine, there's significant room for improvement for the women's sport properties.
Say it's not so.
Yeah. So, I mean, I mentioned to Alicia Clark, since she's a local Las Vegas Aces rep on the Players Association. I didn't get to say anything to Kelsey Plum, but because they're both on the board, but that we have the data. And if they would like to see the data, we would be happy to share it because there's a number of things that, in particular the NBA gets that WNBA doesn't even begin to approach. But this is a really important piece. I'm thinking about we've seen a number of significant women athletes retire, and even just this last week, some big names have announced retirement. But of course, Megan Rapinoe and Sue Bird come to mind as two who are leveraging their celebrity as athletes into, their next phase, becoming the like sports celebrity couple, right, with their podcast and getting a lot of visibility. But it's an incredibly difficult journey. I think we pretty much all of us on this call know that, having been athletes and knowing that when the athletic career is over, there's really not a lot of conversation about what comes next and how you deal with it. On the college sport level, that's one thing. On the pro sport level, it's a whole nother thing when you think about the fact that on average, they're somewhere around 30, right? So they're further into their life, if you will, and some are further behind in a sense. So if you're a WNBA athlete or you're basically a woman in sport, you haven't made the multi-millions of dollars that have set you up for financial security for the rest of your life. So, woe is those multimillionaires that have to figure out what they're going to do with all their money and all their time. But the real challenge is these women who, I think Abby Wambach was one of the first to really bring it to light when she was standing on the ESPY stage, right? Looking at Peyton Manning and I don't know who else and saying, these guys are set and I don't know where my next check's coming from, right? So, yeah, looking into this area, I think there's tremendous work that needs to be done. It appears that most of it has been done by our friends, the sports psychologists, but there's no real model. There's no real, I would say, program for support and community, and even for a lot of these younger people, education about how to get a job and who you're going to be in your next phase of life. But oddly enough, something as simple as how to get a job, right? Write up a resume.
And how to leverage your rich sport experiences that we know the marketplace wants from women athletes, and how to message that, control your narrative, talk about it in ways that make you feel credible and that you're not, making stuff up. But I found in these women, they don't know how to translate. I was a college or pro athlete, and this is how I bring it to the workplace.
100%.
It's so fascinating.
Yeah, 100%. And then so they, like the rest of us, often have their own hangups. I have colleagues who are in high-level executive positions with teams that were formerly high-profile athletes who have said, they have a little bit of imposter syndrome where people are looking at them and thinking, well, you just got your job because, you played on the Olympic team or you were a WNBA All-Star or whatever it may have been. And that imposter syndrome is interesting, right? Because they want to be seen as an executive, as, whatever it is that they're doing in their life, not just as that former athlete. So there's some interesting challenges there, even with the ones who've been tremendously successful as an athlete, right? Wanting to leverage some of that, but also wanting to leave some of it behind in a way to build a new identity and still have credibility in a new role.
Interesting. Such good work. I'm so glad we reconnected and talking about all the good work we're doing. I'll just add one thing I'm working on that is super personal is calling out the sexism and gender bias in the sport workplaces for women, specifically coaches. And I'm using a new tool by Amy Diehl, who's looked at different dimensions of gender bias in workplaces, but not sport. And we have two different studies now that we're looking at the same measure, but in different contexts. And I had done a study using this in the tennis world. The USTA had hired me to look at why women were leaving tennis teaching and coaching and really big numbers post-COVID. And so I use this framework and now I'm really digging into the data. And what's so interesting, because as I just shared with all of you off mic, is that I'm now starting to coach tennis again. And so I'm in the data and then I'm experiencing this now as a more veteran coach, because when I was in my 20s, I didn't have any of this language or theory or ways to understand what I was experiencing. I just know it pissed me off. I was always angry because I was experiencing all kinds of sexism and bias and bullshit. And I just didn't know why it made me so mad. But now that I've gone back to it 30 years later, and just this morning, I'm not kidding you. And I just decided this is going to be a new project because I've threatened to do this for years, is I'm going to do an ethnography of all the ways that I experience bias and sexism in all the different sport contexts I'm in. And I'm going to just do this for one full year. So this morning, I'm going to make this a short story. My group of four women were playing on the court. We were there first. The four men came to the next court next to us. They 30 minutes later, we were playing. They were warming up. Now they're going to play and they're missing a ball. Okay. Clearly, we had stolen it. So there was a guy and he's like, you could hear him talking. Where's the ball? Where's the ball? Where's the ball? I'm like, I've been playing tennis for 40 years. If someone's ball comes on my court, I will see it and I will give it back to you. And this guy was like, do you have a ball? I'm like, no, we don't have your ball. Sorry. And he was just like, that was not acceptable. And he was grumbling. And then every 5 minutes or so, he would say something loudly like, I wonder where that ball went. And I'm like, dude, give it up. We did not steal your ball. And so what it made me feel in like the gender bias piece is like, A, we don't belong there. B, we're lying. And we clearly are like stealing your ball. And that we're not credible enough to know the difference between our ball and your ball. I mean, it just made me so angry the whole way home that I'm like, that's it. I am writing this study, my own experience of gender bias in different sport workplaces, because I'm sick and tired of it. So stay tuned.
I'll be able to add to that, Nicole. I feel like it could be a book.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, start your own ethnography and we'll compare notes, because I'm just like, I am of the age where I am not putting up with this bullshit anymore. And I wanted to take a ball, whether it was their ball or not, because it clearly wasn't. And I was leaving. And what I wanted to do was like, sir, clearly you're very upset about your lost ball. This is not it, but you can have one of mine. So enjoy the rest of your match. But I didn't. Because I don't know these people that well yet. So I didn't want to be like, okay, we've let some crazy lady into our tennis group now, and she's going to be that person. So anyway, I knew you all would understand my pain.
I see you.
Nicole, we need to talk offline, because the deal study is what I did with the skiers and snowboarders.
You did?
And yeah, and I'm doing it probably with tennis in Canada too. So let's chat about it. And it is eye-opening when you give them back the results. They're like, even to the women themselves, to see how all the rest of the women were experiencing what they were experiencing, the power of that in the room with this women that day was like,
yes.
Holy hell. So we're doing it through the industry. We're going to do a worldwide one with them. But yeah, we should start creating a database of all this around the different sport industries. The deal stuff is excellent. Wrote a large grant to do this internationally in the fall. Didn't get it, ooh, sadly. Would have been amazing, but might be able to redo it in the next year with team across from England and from Germany too. So yeah, let's talk about that one offline.
Let's talk. Yes. Okay. Another great synergy coming out of the disruptors.
There you go.
Okay. So as we're wrapping up, this is the end of 2024. We're looking ahead to 2025. What is everyone's prediction or a disruption that could happen in 2025 that you're going to be, you know, going out and saying, I think this could happen?
All right. I got a couple.
Okay. Start us off, Anne.
Picking up with Jada said earlier, to me, this unrivaled basketball league that's coming, and it's going to pay the players more than the WNBA salaries are, given their recent raise of money. So they're going to make more money to play. So I sort of predict these like short micro seasons of sport, 6 weeks events, are going to start being disruptors for women as a place to play outside of their current seasons. And I think it's attracting investors, it's attracting great athletes. So I think we're going to see more of these coming. And this hot off the press this morning, Netflix has signed to do the next two World Cup for women. So I think with streaming services like that coming in to take on mainstream sport, these little micro, calling them micro, I don't even know if they call themselves that, but you know, sort of.
You heard it here first on Tucker Center Talks.
It's micro seasons. Are going to be really popular because they lend themselves well to these like streaming type platforms and to sort of behind the scenes documentaries to go with them in the short sort of intense time of them. So I think those are going to continue to disrupt sort of the current structure of sport and the traditional way of putting it on.
All right. I love that. Micro seasons. You heard it from Ann Peguerrero first.
I think we are going to see definitely more inventory from all the women's leagues. I don't anticipate them to have new verticals that quickly, but they will certainly increase their inventory to monetize as they are looking to generate additional revenues, whether it is additional cups, additional opportunities to get branded, not necessarily just the expansion teams that's already out, but I think they will definitely add these, you know, pop-up events, additional cup games, and different type of inventory to the leagues to generate additional revenues.
Interesting. Okay, who's got their next disruption? Katie, take it away.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting because women's sports are expanding so quickly. I think fans are going to start to hold them a little more accountable, or at least I hope they will. And I think the market has been so untapped and people have been so desperate to see women's sport. And this is probably an unpopular opinion, but they've been able to get away with some things. And I imagine that fans will start to maybe have some things to say. We're seeing that with the PWHL already in its second season. Been some issues with scheduling. There's been some, turnouts that have not kept pace. And again, when fans have more options, they will be able to shape the market a little bit more. And so it'll be interesting to see how women's sports react to that. I think maybe part and parcel of that issue is that the women's professional teams have continued to be under-resourced largely compared to their male counterparts. They've been expected to produce the same kind of experience with a quarter of the staff, if that, in some cases. There's been high turnover in terms of the human resources on the women's sports side. So those are some issues that I'm kind of optimistically hoping we'll be able to get through, but I expect the honeymoon phase won't last forever. And there will be some bumps in the road as there's more and more women's sports out there to choose from and different experiences. So I think that's the next growth for women's sport to get through that. And so I'm excited to see how that will elevate women's sport, but I do imagine there could be some bumps coming forward.
Great. All right. Next disruption.
Yeah, I agree with Katie, and I'm really curious to see how specifically mainstream media organizations are going to navigate that because, we've gone from really very little coverage to now a lot of, a lot more visibility, and we see an expansion of voices who are talking about women's sports, which of course has its complex issues around them. But I'm thinking specifically about the relationship between women's sports teams and journalists who cover them regularly, right? So not the voices who sort of jump in, but really that relationship between women's sports teams and journalists on the local level. And so I'm really curious to see, how journalists will see their responsibility. Is it to bring visibility to the games, to the athletes, to make the local connections? Is it going to be to hold coaches and management accountable? Is it going to be to provide human interest coverage, to provide sociocultural coverage? And I think it's probably going to be a little bit of all of the above, depending on the media outlet. But I think, as Katie mentioned, we're still in some, especially I think with the PWHL, there was a lot of sort of like growth and excitement and sort of kind of a little bit of forgetting that women's hockey has existed for a long time, right? So I'll be really interested in seeing what that relationship both between journalists and women's sports organizations looks like, and then between fans and women's sports organizations. Are fans going to demand more and more consistency or more merchandise and more communication or better fan experience, right? So I don't think that the process is going to be linear at all. I think there will be a lot of ups and downs, and the disruptions are not going to sort of lead automatically to change. I think there is still too many structural forces that create very complicated conditions for women's sports.
Yeah, good add on. I'm going to jump in, and I don't even know if this idea is fully formed. So maybe you all can help me think. But I think one of the disruptions will be as women athletes in the collegiate space, I'm thinking basketball, volleyball, specifically basketball, who have big NIL deals in college, now graduate. And they're in leagues, say the WNBA, but they've made all this money in college with NIL and now sponsorship deals. I'm wondering if this will start to disrupt the professional space because these young women are like, I made all this money in college and this is the status quo. So what are you going to do for me now? And I'm wondering if they will feel a sense to advocate for that for themselves, or if it will just organically happen. I don't know how to say that, but I think that could be a really big disruption.
Yeah, I'm going to jump on that, Nicole, because the college sports space is about to get very controversial. And so, I mentioned college football a little while ago, and what I see as the major disruption coming is lawsuits. and it's over Title IX. So one of the speculations I have heard is out of this new model of college football and all of the money that's coming, that 75% of the revenue is going to stay with college football, 15% is going to go to men's basketball, 5% to women's sport, and 5% to non-revenue sport. And when you hear that, you hear gender equity is clearly not even a consideration, which means, again, we're going to go back to the path of it's going to take lawsuits. It's going to require that those that believe in women's sport are willing to fight for it. And I think you're spot on in the sense that some of these women that have had major NILs understand that they have a platform. I don't know how many of them really understand the social justice piece of it, or how many of them will be willing to position themselves in sort of an advocacy role. But I'm hopeful because, you know, some of us are aging out of the advocacy world. And we need some of those young women who've been privileged and had some incredible experiences that some of us could have never even dreamed of to step up and start fighting, because this is never going to stop being a fight. And I hate saying that. I wish I didn't have to say that. I wish I could change that narrative. But there is absolutely no question in my mind that there is so much more change that's needed with regard to women taking the power that we have and using it in meaningful ways to change sport for the better.
Yeah. Jada, what do you have to add?
I don't want to shift it to a different direction, but I think these women making, you know, enormous amount of money through name, image, and likeness deals during their college career are well on their way to become investors. Just saw it with Juju Watkins investing in Unrivaled. We have seen, you know, we're seeing Caitlin Clark being part of different, you know, bidding committees or, you know, new investors to franchises. So I think they're on their way to understand the power of their personal brand, but they also understand that by continuing to stay top of mind, they are able to continue with endorsement deals, and they are using their funds and, you know, current appeal to be part of investment groups. I think that is going to shape the future of women's sports, because we are seeing Sue Bird is a part owner to a team. We are seeing Megan Rapinoe is a part owner to a team, right? So even, you know, younger rookies in WNBA being able to part of, you know, investment groups for different franchises. So I think they will certainly have a long-term impact on women's sport in the US, but maybe globally in time. So I do feel they are going to continue to, you know, push the boundaries. And if we go back, I'll give an example from probably a colleague our age, Jennifer Todd, who actually sued Brown University for a Title IX case long ago. And she was one of the co-owners of the TBT. So she is that group also launched TSD, and now she is currently working at Boston Celtics as a vice president, but she is contributing to the industry. She made one of those first investments to a micro league and mentioned, right? So these women, Paige Becker and others, will become investors and will contribute to the growth of the industry, in my opinion.
I love that.
And I might jump on that just a little bit, Nicole. So on a very positive side, I heard just today about two very high profile positions, one with Major League Baseball and the other one, I think, with the NFL, that are going to be held by women. And I think that's another piece that is starting to really shift, is we're seeing women in incredibly powerful roles in all aspects of sport and even in the sponsorship realm. And I think as that continues to happen, you know, like the head of the Washington Mystics, the president and CEO, she came from industry. And like it or not, I think these women that have that kind of experience are going to really change the sport industry, because they've worked in outside of sport and have different expectations coming into sport.
Absolutely. I think, I mean, it really is going to be so interesting. And I will say this, a year from now, we're going to get back on at the end of 2025, and we'll see how we did and what we predict will come true in 2026. So before we wrap, does anybody else have a disruption prediction that they didn't get to say? Anne?
All right, let's be really, really bold and say we're going to see the first $1 billion franchise for women's sport. I think what we saw with Angel City and the growth in a really short period of time, whether it's 25 or early 26, I feel like there's going to be a women's sport property that's going to hit $1 billion as a franchise value. And to me, that's a tipping point when we see those valuations, the 500 or 5,000% return on the Angel City $3 million is attracting people like crazy, and it's going to keep driving up the values. And it's really happening fast. Will we get fully there? But I want to just be bold and say, let's see the $1 billion franchise happen.
Love it. Anybody else want to be bold before we wrap? Nancy.
I'll jump in where Anne's going and say we're going to see more private equity coming into women's sport, and that's going to be another major disruption. So you mentioned the Michelle Kangs, Anne earlier, and others. I think we're going to see more of that, especially as they start showing the success on their side. Those people that are heading those equity firms are going to start giving or investing in women's sport in a meaningful way.
Okay. If there's no more bold predictions from the disruptors, I will have to say that this was amazingly fun way to end our year. And you are all amazing women doing amazing work. And I will say that's a wrap for this episode of Tucker Center Talks with the original group of disruptors. Be sure to check out our many free evidence-based resources on our website at tuckercenter.org and follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram. This podcast was produced by Tucker team member Lindsay Hofer. Thank you, Lindsay, and thank you for listening to Tucker Center Talks. As we wrap, give yourself grace, support others, and let the data tell the story in ways that help us all accelerate systems change for girls and women in sport. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.